Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The seizure of the U.S. Capitol this week has raised several concerns and questions about the future of American democracy. Was this a coup attempt? Is this beginning an era of undemocratic actions against peaceful transitions after elections? Is the Trump presidency an anomaly to American democracy? Doug Becker explores these questions and more.
I'm Doug Becker. On Wednesday, January 6, a mob emboldened by the encouragement of the U.S. President Donald Trump seized control of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. While the attempt to block the transition of the government to Joseph R. Biden failed, these events resemble a coup d'etat. On today's show, we examine how authoritarian governments can lead to coups and how much this coup attempt resembles others internationally. Our guests are Nandinal Singh, Associate Professor at the U.S. Naval War College and author of Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups, and Annie Ming, Assistant Professor at the University of Virginia and the author of Constraining Dictatorship, From Personalized Rule to Institutionalized Regimes. Professor Singh, my first question is to you. I described this in the introduction as an attempted coup d'etat. Is that an accurate description, or how would you describe the events that took place on Wednesday?
Thanks, Doug. I argue it's not a coup. Let me explain why, and then let me explain why I think that matters to the extent to which it matters. So first up, I understand why people see things that resemble a coup. It was an illegitimate power grab. It was an attempt to stop democracy from functioning. But there's one critical ingredient which is different here. And that has to do with who's engaging in the action. In this case, what we saw was a rabble, a mob of ordinary citizens, some of whom are right-wing ultranationalists and white supremacists, but still civilians, as opposed to members of the state security forces. Now, why is it that I think that matters? I think that matters because I think the dynamics of the event are very different, depending on whether the leader is using his authorities as a head of state or whether he is trying to use his bully pulpit. And this is going to cut a couple ways. One of them is, this was as traumatic as this was, both symbolically and to all the people who were there, this was not as dangerous as if it had involved state security forces. In fact, as we saw with many other protests, the police are more than capable of handling this rabble, this mob. And they could have done so if they planned for it. And so they're not really that much of a threat that's being posed here. The other part of this, though, is that the threat isn't going to go away on January 21st. It's not going to go away after the inauguration. Because Donald Trump is not using the powers of the presidency, but instead using his bully pulpit, because he's not using the powers of the presidency, but instead using his own personal appeal, that means he can continue to do so afterwards. And that suggests a mode of dealing with him. We saw Facebook suspend his account for the next 2 weeks. Twitter suspended him briefly. If in fact he gets cut, if he were treated like any other American citizen who was fomenting a violent rebellion, he would get cut off from the media. And if he was cut off from Facebook, Twitter, and the mainstream media, he would be left with the Epoch Times, Russia Today, and OANN. And I think that would very much limit his ability to cause the kind of damage that he's doing. So this is why I think the definition matters. The definition contains in it a description, a diagnosis, and also with it a prognosis, a set of remedies. Now, I am not personally hung up on definitions. I don't work on taxonomies. I understand why it is that people want to use the term coup much more broadly than I do. The point is simply whether or not whether or not our analysis is going to lead us to effectively dealing with this threat to democracy.
And Professor Meng, I think one of the reasons why calling this a coup has become so popular is to firmly put in place the president as an agent of this action, that this wasn't something that happened spontaneously, but at least was something that was encouraged by the president. What exactly is that relationship? Because when you think of a coup, you typically think of it as against a sitting president. The idea of a sitting president launching a coup against his own government seems a little bit counterintuitive. Are there precedents for sitting presidents trying to use something extrajudicial against their own government?
Sure. I completely agree with Nana Hall's diagnosis of this. I don't think this is a coup, even though some have made the argument that Trump encouraged a lot of these dynamics. So Trump is certainly not the first democratic or autocratic leader to exhibit anti-democratic properties or characteristics. And I think that what's really important is to take a step back and to reassess a lot of fundamental ideas that we probably haven't questioned for too long. So first of all, democracy and autocracy are not black and white categories. They completely exist on a spectrum. So almost all democracies have authoritarian characteristics, and plenty of autocracies have democratic characteristics. Another idea that we actually really need to rethink and re-examine is just this very foundational idea that America has been a democracy and is a democracy, right? So as a scholar of authoritarian regimes, I gotta say that the history of America looks incredibly authoritarian to me. So first of all, just even by very simple, basic, minimalist procedural definitions of democracy, we didn't even have universal suffrage until 1965, right? So women didn't have the right to vote until 1920, and Black people didn't have the right to vote until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. So even by the most basic definition of having universal political participation, the US at best can be considered a democracy starting in 1965. So we've only been a democracy for 55 years. And I think that we also need to kind of re-examine this idea that we were constructed to be a democracy of, by, and for the people. The founders were elites that wrote a constitution that completely enshrined their own political and economic power, right? It's not an accident that more than half of the population did not have suffrage. It is not an accident that we have things such as the Electoral College, which is a very bizarre way to choose a leader. These institutional decisions that were constructed by the founders were not accidental. They are authoritarian. These are very common strategies that autocratic leaders use all around the world, right? Strategies like gerrymandering, strategies like writing certain types of electoral rules to entrench the elites that are already in power. So I think that we really need to be critical of this idea that America was a great democracy and it suddenly started to fall apart in the last 5 years. You know, returning to this question of how did we get a leader like Trump who suddenly is just acting so, you know, authoritarian now? I think that Trump is maybe a little more willing to be kind of blatantly authoritarian in his language. But as I've mentioned before, we've had plenty of authoritarian type characteristics this whole time. Gerrymandering, the Electoral College, things like that. FDR stayed past the norm of two terms. Presidents have definitely stepped beyond the bounds of power before. I think maybe what we're seeing now is kind of maybe different language and a more kind of willingness to openly embrace authoritarian type identities. Putting these two ideas together, I actually think that what we're seeing now is a reaction to increasing democratization, not democratic backsliding. What we've been seeing is as previously marginalized groups gain more political power in terms of expanding access to vote, as well as previously marginalized groups gaining more representation in government, these previous elites and previous groups that benefited from these kind of old structures of power are being challenged. And so now we're seeing a really violent reaction against that, right? And so I would argue that in a kind of strangely counterintuitive way, we're seeing violent reactions against democratization in the US.
Now, Professor Singh, this kind of creates a little bit of an existential question in my mind, in that you're arguing this is not a coup in part because of the reaction, you know, to the president since Wednesday. but Professor Ming highlights that there are these authoritarian tendencies anyway. So I guess part of what I've been wrestling with is, if it's not a coup because the government's not acting in a way where it believes that it's all that threatened by the president, is it that what we're really seeing exposed is kind of this authoritarian streak that doesn't show the same level of outrage institutionally that individuals are showing as a result of the actions on Wednesday?
Two things. Firstly, just to clarify slightly, the distinction I was drawing earlier was just that there's a big difference between when the military does it and when civilians do it. Now, you're right, civilians could have caused a lot of damage. It's just that that by and large, they're less capable of doing so than the United States military or the DHS or any number of state security organs. But I do think you're pointing at something else here as well, which is the way in which this threat was not considered very seriously. The police didn't plan for it. Heck, even Lindsey Graham said that this was not treated nearly as seriously as the Black Lives Matter protests. The Black Lives Matter protests were peaceful, and these ones were violent. And so you're absolutely right to point out that the police didn't consider this seriously, and they failed to do so even as the protesters left the mall and got closer and closer and closer in. And part of this does have to do with the fact that there are certain segments of society that apologize for authoritarian tendencies or that identify with some of the grievances of the protesters. So if I remember right, the head of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police, a police union with 13,000 people, said, look, this was no big deal. There's a little bit of property damage, a little bit of trespassing, but there wasn't much that went on. And it's an incident in which one policeman was killed, one protester was shot. There were several other deaths, but there was a good deal more violence than that. And so part of the reason why this happens goes back to Annie's point, which is to say, in countries which have a history of authoritarianism, some of this gets taken for granted, and certain kinds of threats are not treated as seriously as other kinds of threats are. On today's 538, there is an article running which talks about differential policing. And they say that the police were twice as likely to crack down on left-wing protesters than right-wing protesters. And this was true even in cases where the left-wing protesters were entirely nonviolent.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the mob seizure of the Capitol building on January 6th and its implications with Professors Nandanal Singh and Annie Meng. And Annie Meng, that is certainly an issue that's been raised, the type of reaction from the police when they're talking about a largely white and a conservative group of protesters versus, for instance, the Black Lives Matter protests. I guess one of the questions I have here is that then, is the fact that that point is being laid bare in our discourse since those actions, do you see this as an opening for a greater level of democratization? The fact that it's pretty clear as a part of the discourse that one of the lessons learned here is who's doing the protest matters with respect to how the police and how any form of security responds to that. Are we going to come out more democratic on the other side?
I think that it could go either way, and it could be that both of these things happen. So on one hand, we have been democratizing more. You know, the Senate elections in Georgia show that mobilization to counter voter suppression tactics can work. That was very promising, right? And I think that it shows that these efforts to continue democratizing can work. And I think that with the fact that we've been getting a more kind of diverse and representative Congress and that elected officials are getting more, you know, diverse and the newer generation are kind of very vocal about these things, I think it is possible that people are just becoming a lot more aware of these things. And I think that it's good both for kind of political consciousness and being politically active and just trying to get a lot more people kind of to participate in democracy, right? Which are all good things for democracy. However, on the other hand, I think that a potential danger and what worries me in terms of not being able to democratize further is that democracy is kind of like this weird thing where I think it's kind of like money. It's this like made up thing that we all believe in and it works because we all believe in it, right? But if like tomorrow we all decide that money is just useless paper, then it completely loses its value. Democracy is kind of the same way, right? We all buy into it and it works because we all buy into it and we agree to vote and not march and break down the doors of the Capitol building, right? And so I'm afraid that this is going to kind of develop norms of political violence. And so if we start to see more and more election-related violence, then I would be really worried about norms of kind of peaceful voting and, you know, these beliefs about democracy breaking down. And I think that that's really dangerous because at the end of the day, democracy is just this idea that everybody needs to buy into, right? That's what sustains it.
Nanan Al Singh, you wanted to respond to that as well.
No, I wanted to agree with what Annie was saying, that democracy rests upon a shared understanding amongst the people. And there are a whole bunch of not only norms, but expectations. And the reason why losers are willing to step down is because they understand that if they win, the next time round, the other side will step down. But if we start to damage the norm that that elections which are conducted fairly, their outcomes are accepted, the consequences of that can be quite damaging. Now, what I'm finding is particularly worrisome here is the fact that there are a number of political actors who know better, right? There are a number of, for example, prominent senators who were very clear in 2016 about the dangers that they saw of Trump's election, who are now backing what is a very specious set of claims about election irregularities. I am sure that Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Lindsey Graham all know better. But they're engaging in this because they're opportunistic. What that's telling us, though, is that the penalties for this sort of behavior are low enough and the benefits are high enough, given the nature of the Republican Party, given the kinds of media discourse we have, it's given the levels of polarization that exist, that they feel that they can do this without consequence. And that is very alarming to me. Norms don't simply reproduce themselves automatically. Elites need to commit to them. They need to observe them. And average citizens need to commit to them and observe them. And what we're seeing here is some extremely cynical behavior by elites that could be very damaging. And I pick those three names in particular because they all made very clear statements about Donald Trump in 2016. And they're all fairly intelligent people. So there's no reason to believe their behavior is anything but cynical and opportunistic.
Annie Meng, since democratization is, you know, is a norm, one of the things that we've learned over the course of these last 4 years, and perhaps as you suggested, a lot longer than that, a lot of these norms that we have held up as relatively sacrosanct really are not. And they can come tumbling down pretty quickly. So for small D Democrats, people committed to these democratic norms, how do we get back to considering any of these norms as sacrosanct? Is the only option that we need to codify it in law? And even that depends on the willingness to actually enforce those laws.
That's a really hard question, right? And the causes of democratization and how to get democracies to consolidate is probably one of the oldest political science questions that maybe hasn't been fully, you know, adjudicated at this point. There's been a little bit of survey work done, and what we have found is that kind of like everyday American citizens are actually kind of frighteningly authoritarian sometimes. For instance, everyday people actually don't rate the importance of checks and balances in government as highly as political scientists kind of rate them or think that they're important. there's kind of a nascent scholarly literature going on right now in terms looking at democratic erosion and how to stop it. And right now I'm seeing a lot of solutions being proposed that rely on kind of voters being like the actor to stop democratic backsliding. I think that that's not sufficient. It's not enough to just hope that voters will do the right thing. Unfortunately, I think that a lot of these problems are cyclical. There needs to be institutional changes. For instance, getting rid of abolishing the Electoral College would be great. But again, these problems are cyclical. I don't know if there would be the political will to do that because there are plenty of politicians right now that are benefiting from the Electoral College who would be completely unwilling to abolish it. I do think that a lot of these kind of on the ground efforts to at least kind of expand access to voting is a kind of really important and kind of foundational step in all of this.
There are a few things that elites could do as well. You saw there was a complete turnaround in the way that social media companies behaved between the point at which they thought they were being regulated by Republicans to the point at which they realized they were about to be regulated by Democrats. They applied their standards consistently to Donald Trump for the first time. I suspect we're going to start seeing some changes in the way that Fox News behaves as well. And I think that matters a lot. But there are other things too. One of the things is that because there's a huge concentration of both wealth and power in America, the decisions of a few people can have a disproportionate influence. And right now we live in a world where when a senator leaves office or when certain congressional representatives leave office, they can move into fairly lucrative circles. They can become lobbyists. They can consult for a hedge fund. They can be on the boards of corporations. But all of these are things that a fairly small number of people could decide not to do. If in fact, let's say a senator had been a prominent supporter, vocal supporter of ISIS, although couched in a theoretical way, he would never get a chance to sit on a corporate board and, you know, earn $25,000 every time he showed up for a meeting. Well, we could treat if we decide that we're not going to let people get away with undemocratic behavior, if we are going to, for the rest of their lives, remind them of the decisions that they made and the consequences that come from that decision, it is possible for elites to impose penalties on people who violate their norms. You know, Ted Cruz goes to his Princeton reunion every year, and he will feel very differently if the people over there greet him as if he is someone who decided to spit on democracy.
Now, Annie Meng, there's another consequence to all of this that I've been considering. That's the U.S. has typically been a world voice favoring democratization, encouraging democratization worldwide. And I know the international reaction to the events this week has been pretty shocking, and not the least of which is this notion that the U.S. has really lost quite a bit of legitimacy speaking on behalf of global democratization. How real is this threat, and do you see any sort of consequences to that?
Well, I have a pretty cynical view on the U.S. as a beacon of democracy, both at home and worldwide. I think there's a couple angles to consider here. So first of all, a concern might be that the U.S. behaving very anti-democratically might encourage kind of like a global norm where authoritarianism is more accepted as a model of government or something like that. I don't know if that really makes a real difference in terms of how regimes are being structured and whether they are democratizing or not. Elites worldwide are going to design institutions in the way that benefit them. I can't think of a country that decided to democratize or not democratize because they were like so inspired by the American example. I think kind of like beyond maybe this just like veneer of America appearing democratic to the rest of the world, if we want to think about kind of like America's democracy promoting agenda abroad, I also have a very cynical view of that. We apply it extremely inconsistently, and we have strong alliances with plenty of dictatorships when it suits us. Like, we're friends with Saudi Arabia. So we're extremely inconsistent with our democracy promotion agenda anyways. Furthermore, there's been a lot of work that shows that democracy promotion abroad actually has kind of like really bad unintended consequences, in that these kind of democracy promotion efforts or things like election monitoring in other countries are often extremely shallow. We basically give a lot of these countries a very crude checklist that's very easy for them to kind of check off on the surface. So it is not a surprise that the average dictatorship today looks like a democracy. That's in part because of these very shallow and superficial kind of like democracy promotion efforts, right? And this kind of global norm towards appearing democratic. The average dictatorship today has elections, has parties, has opposition parties, has a functioning legislature. And basically every country has kind of learned the language of democracy and how to appear democratic, right? And so I think that democracy promotion was already very flawed to begin with. And so I think that these concerns are maybe premised on something that honestly might have hurt real efforts towards democratization.
So we've been discussing the events of this week, the impact that it has on our understanding of what actually constitutes a coup d'etat, the responses to this sort of undemocratic or anti-democratic action, and the potential this could have for democratization worldwide. Our guests today have been Nandanil Singh, associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. He is the author of Seizing Power, The Strategic Logic of Military Coups. And Annie Meng, she is the assistant professor at the University of Virginia and is the author of Constraining Dictatorship, From Personalized Rule to Institutionalized Regimes. Thank you both very much.